What is biblical justice? Pull out your definitions. Some of you, thank you for trying to turn them in, because after my scary speech yesterday, I'm sure some of you were like, I just got to get this right in there. And I appreciate it. That is normally how that will function. But today I want you to have it there so that we can discuss it, because we're going to start off with you just giving some of the definitions that you found for justice. Not your own definition yet. We'll get to that. But what are some of the definitions you found for justice? Go. Yeah, go ahead. Jeremiah.
The quality of being fair and reasonable.
The quality of being fair and reasonable. That's pretty vague, but good. Yeah. Good. It's not your definition, so I can say that. Where would that come from?
Just Google justice.
Okay, interesting. So what does the word quality mean? What does fair mean? Good. Okay. Others? Yes?
I had a couple that said basically each person receiving what they're due.
Receiving what they were due. Interesting. Okay. So the concept of, yes. Okay, receiving what they're due. Matter of fact, it even reminds me of a picture. That's why it stopped me for a moment, because words didn't come to my mind, but a picture did. The picture of the statue of the woman, the goddess Justice, that has the blindfold over her eyes. And what is she holding? Scales. Why? Because justice is blind. It gives everyone exactly what they're due. Yeah, interesting. Okay. Other stuff? Yes?
Justice is a concept of moral rightness based on ethics, rationality, law, natural law, religion, equity or fairness, as well as the administration of the law.
Really? Where did that come from? Interesting. I can't believe they threw the word religion in there. Huh. Wikipedia. It's actually a better source than what people give it credit for. Go ahead. Don't cite it in any of the papers you write for me, though. Anyway, go ahead.
I also took from Wikipedia, and it kind of...
it goes on a lot. Yeah.
Sure, no, that's great. Yeah, go ahead. Is what?
How American it sounded.
How American it sounded. Interesting.
It talks about civil rights, and you could just hear the history of our country.
Just kind of ringing.
Huh. Really interesting.
So justice, on some level, what you're saying, might be defined more culturally than... Because what's interesting about the same Wikipedia article is it seems to be on that level, trying to put it on this supra-contextualist level. And yet, one of the things you notice in the same article is how cultural it really sounded. That's interesting. Yes?
The next line says, taking into account the inalienable and immoral rights of all human beings as citizens.
Where'd that come from?
I wonder, in Cuba, their definition of justice would be different.
That's a good question. That may be even something to keep in mind if you're doing justice cross-culturally. That maybe the justice that you define as far as socially here may be the exact opposite of justice if you went somewhere else. That's a good thought, good question. Other definitions? Yeah,
Kate. I asked on Facebook for my social media.
Yeah.
And someone said, having done to you what you did to someone else, and someone else said, equality to all.
Equality to all. Huh. Having done to you what was done to someone else? Is that what that's?
What you did to someone else.
What you did to someone else. Whoa. Okay. So that's similar to the justice is blind concept. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Okay. Other definitions? Yes?
I found a quote on Twitter from International Justice Mission by Bill Moyers.
Good.
And it says, charity provides crumbs from the table. Justice offers a place at the table.
Huh. Interesting. So that's even defining justice through contrast. Charity provides crumbs from the table, where justice provides a place at the table. So you see there in that definition, it's a systemic issue for him. Justice is system-based. And I'm not saying that's wrong or bad. We're just, right now, we're not even giving answers necessarily. We're just making observations. Everybody hear that? Okay. That's an interesting contrast. And it may, in some sense, suggest... This is one of the things I loved about my Christian life class. What I loved about my Christian life class when we were talking about justice issues is that I could see the heart in the students changing. But sometimes the heart without the wisdom or without the knowledge to go with it can be just as destructive if not having the heart at all. And that's one of the things I saw was there was a lot of people with the need to help, but then they would get themselves in ridiculous situations and they wouldn't know how to deal with it because a lot of times they were paving the way with their heart, but justice wasn't coming along because they weren't thinking through systems. They weren't thinking through, man, just handing them and that's it, the money, although that's at least a step, doesn't necessarily cure the problem. And now, it can help some people in certain situations, and that's one of the things I don't like. This, so I never give money to anyone ever. And I'm like, well, we have a spirit too. And frankly, if I make a mistake and give somebody some money, and they did, that's not going to help them, I'm okay with that, actually, on some level. But now, if that's my only practice, that becomes dangerous. Is this making sense? But there could be something we got to keep in mind is that there are systems at play here. Interesting. Okay. Other stuff, other definitions. Yes, yeah, Morgan?
A proper proportion between a person's merits and the good and bad things that befall or are allotted to him.
Proper proportion. Do you hear that initial alliteration? Interesting. Okay, based on that definition, now I want to ask the next question. What happens if we put the word biblical in front of the word justice? Does it shift or does it stay the same? Tell me your definitions or your thought process. You don't need to read your definition. You can even just, if you just want to think out loud, go ahead. That's fine. Yeah.
I know that a lot of these definitions talk about like the proportion of what you deserve based on what you should like receive. And I think that when you add biblical to that, then you take into account stuff like grace and you don't get what you receive. You get like more than what you receive.
Isn't that an interesting point? She just like, did everybody hear that over on this side? Because I know sometimes in between the lectern it can get muffled. I don't know why, it's just the lectern effect. Yeah, what do we do when we're coming with justice and we have to wrestle with the concept of grace? Does that shift our definition of, I mean, like we heard some of the I'm not saying non-Christian in the sense of the IJM guy wasn't non-Christian. I'm just saying the non-necessarily Christian definitions. And there was a strong emphasis of equal proportion. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. But does that always make sense when we're defining it biblically? So then what are your thoughts? What are your definitions? Be bold and somebody read their definition. Yeah, go ahead.
Like regular judgment, I think is making fairness, but mm-hmm. I think biblical justice is restoring God as like the leader of everything and the ruler of everything that has more power. So
what I just heard you say there is real important, is that the end goal in biblical justice isn't always the same as what you find in non-Christian justice. The end goal is the same, not the same. This is something that's really important, and we're going to talk just for like 5 minutes on something that's a little bit bigger than justice, but it will impact it. These ethical, one of the things that will separate us, and we'll talk about this between the NGOs and things of that nature, is what is called the telos. Telos is actually a transliterated Greek word that just means the end. The end. And I do not believe, first of all, in the pragmatic understanding of the end justifies the means. I don't believe that. Matter of fact, Jesus doesn't believe that. And that was the very crux of the temptation of Satan in Matthew chapter 4. He says, go ahead, bow down and worship me, and you will then get all the kingdoms of the earth. Was Jesus, was his telos, all the kingdoms of the earth? Yeah, actually it was. He wanted to establish his kingdom to swallow up the world. That was his goal. But in that moment, the end did not justify the means. The means was very important to Jesus. No, I'm not going to bow down and worship you. Because what Satan's offering there is, I'll give you the kingdom without a cross. And Jesus says, sorry, the means is just as important as the end. So I want to make that point. However, if you have no end, then your means are affected. And this is what we find a lot of times whenever I'll see people, they'll say things like, and I've even said these in the past, and it's just flat out wrong. Man, if that person would just give their life to Jesus, I mean, they really wouldn't have to change much about themselves at all anyway. I mean, they pretty much live like a Christian anyway, so man, why don't they just believe in Jesus and then they'll have the whole package? Here's the problem with that. First of all, that's an indictment on Christians. If a non-Christian can live the life of a Christian without the Holy Spirit and Jesus, there's not something good about the non-Christian. There's something wrong with the Christian, first of all. Second of all, ethical living with no telos is meaningless. Alistair MacIntyre wrote a book called After Virtue. Where in the first 150 pages, he describes the importance of a telos and what separates us. And people will act like, no, it's just about being a good person. No, the telos actually changes what good even means. The telos actually even changes what a person even means. The end goal of your ethical actions is almost more important than the ethical actions themselves. Now, I said almost. I'm not saying that I'm going to say the end justifies the means, because I'm not saying that. However, if you have no telos, if you don't have a clear picture of what it is that you're trying to accomplish, ultimately everything you're going to be doing here will be good intentions gone awry. Does that make sense? No, our goal in justice is fundamentally different than the world's. And it has something to do with restoring God or transformation. But we'll get to that in a minute. Other definitions. Yes?
I'm going to say mine and then I'll
explain. No, it's totally fine. Yeah, go ahead.
Becoming weaved into the journey of restoring earth to its genesis. And the reason it was somewhat vague is because I think biblical justice also includes ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if we aren't constantly being renewed into the likeness of Christ, we can't be moving into Genesis either. So for us to be
There's two words in that definition I loved. The word journey and the word Genesis. And I love that you ended with the word Genesis. Because on some sense, that's describing our telos. That's what you're exactly with even the word, the English word Genesis even means, and yet it has the double entendre of the biblical for the first book of the Bible. Yeah, and the journey concept. What we're gonna look at here in just a minute is biblical justice is a part of finding yourself in the middle of a story. And if you don't know the story, you won't know the telos and you won't know the means. You won't know either one. You've got to know both. No, I like that. That's really good. Yes, Morgan.
I was thinking through it, and I thought, would there be any justice if there weren't, like, without injustice, we wouldn't need justice. And so I thought of it as a response and reflection of biblically immoral or unethical actions and ideas.
Okay, so in a sense, there's the related aspect there of the restoration of something. If, in other words, let me just put it in other more theological terms. If the fall didn't happen, there'd be no need for the justice. Because in a sense, the fall brings in the need for something to be set right. Matter of fact, this is one of the definitions of justice that N.T. Wright gives. It's setting the wrongs right. Setting the wrongs right. Now, actually, I think that it needs to be bigger than that, but we'll get that in a minute. But that is definitely an element. If you don't have that element, then you don't understand what the whole story of the Bible is about. After Genesis 3, what is every action of God intending to do? Ending in Revelation 21 and 22. What is the goal? It's not just quote-unquote heaven. It's setting all of the wrongs right. That's the purpose of the story. And it, on some level, should be the purpose of our story in relation to biblical justice, setting the wrongs right. Now, how you do that is real important, but we'll get to that in a minute. Any other definitions? Yes?
I have mine kind of broken up into three parts.
Cool, that's great.
First part's kind of about justice, judgment.
So mm-hmm.
The receiving of what one's actions deserve, or the restoring of what has been taken or withheld. And the second part is kind of like our part, what we do, the loosing of bondage of the oppressed through honest and righteous avenue. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you're fine, go ahead.
Avenue is that, glorify God.
Mm-hmm.
And then I
Yeah, absolutely. And in a sense, what you're doing, if I was gonna put each of those three movements as a key picture in the story, what I see is fall, cross, church. I mean, if I'm gonna just put an image with each of those. Matter of fact, let me go ahead and do this. Let's throw some images up on the screen. And the reason why that's important is because sometimes images can help us understand biblical justice than even our words. So What do you see here, and why would this be considered biblical justice?
Breaking through a barrier.
Breaking through a barrier. Absolutely. What else?
New life.
New life. What else?
Freedom.
What's that?
Freedom.
Freedom? Elaborate. I don't disagree.
Freedom of kind of like a barrier,
Kind of like a breaking through. Yes, absolutely. Bursting power. This does communicate some pretty strong power, by the way, does it not? I mean, those are little plants breaking through concrete. The same concrete that my, you know, several hundred pound car rides on. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. I ruined your answer. That was another hand. Yes, go ahead.
Something that was probably there before, like coming back.
That's interesting, because this, one of the things I thought whenever I looked at this is I sat there and thought, biblical justice is uncovering what the world has covered up. There is a part of that that is definitely that. What the world covers up and paves over, biblical justice breaks through and says, there's still something below the surface. Matter of fact, another line I wrote whenever I saw this is, biblical justice relishes in the impossible becoming possible. That's not supposed to happen. They take great measures for this not to happen. Great measures. Figuring out the best composition of the hardest material so that it can last for a long time. Destroying and running over and steamrolling and putting layer on layer of rock so that this does not happen. But that's biblical justice. What about this picture? Similar but different. What's your eye drawn to? Say it again. The flowers. That's interesting. What do you see? What is this? How does this communicate biblical justice?
Beauty where there is none.
That's exactly the first word I wrote down whenever I saw this. Biblical justice is beauty amidst barrenness. And it looks like a pretty desolate area, and yet there's something beautiful right in the middle of all of it. What else do you see? This one is different because this one doesn't burst through the concrete, does it? What does it do? Moves through a crack, in which made me sit there and think, biblical justice just stinking finds a way. It just finds a way. And it may be just this one little crack, this one little crevice in the fiber of society, and biblical justice can burgeon through there and create new life. That's what it does. Beyond all odds. And again, there's much more going on below the surface than what actually appears. An intricate web of veins and of water and of life that you don't always see. What do you see here? Why would I show this and say, this has something to do with the definition of biblical justice?
Provision,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
New creation.
If you look in the back there, this is a picture in a slum. It's a garden right in the middle of a slum. New life in the middle of desecration, in the middle of poverty. What else? Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like it's like a means to an end, to fix the problem, like a garden rather than just, if you want to think about it metaphorically, it is giving someone a job like them to treat the books.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the whole, don't just give them a piece of fish, teach them how to fish. Absolutely. Biblical justice is, and that, what I would look at that and say is, it's transforming. It's giving life where there's death. It's bringing beauty where there is ugliness. What about this one? This one's going to look a little bit different. But this one, actually, let me go ahead and describe to you this one, because this one's a little bit closer to home. This is a group of people that my little brother lived with for 2 years in North City, St. Louis. North City, St. Louis is not the worst part in St. Louis, because East St. Louis just holds that trophy for the whole nation. But North St. Louis is a close second. Matter of fact, if you go to St. Louis, there's what's called the King's Highway Divide. And on one side of King's Highway, literally, there's million-dollar homes. And you cross this 4-to-6-lane road, and on the other side, it is absolute poverty, devastation, and just incredibly crime-ridden. My little brother lived with these people and his wife. They lived with them in a house. There was about 10 of them. And I was reading Yahoo headlines one day and saw this guy had broken into a home and then ended up getting shot and killed. And they were, you know, there were some issues about, you know, defending with the gun, all that stuff. And I texted my brother and I said, "Hey, I read this article online. How close was this to you?" He said, "Two doors down." They literally, in a period of 8 months, they were broken into 5 different times. So he had his guitar stolen, his computer stolen twice, and that's just where they lived. But what are they doing here? My brother's not in this picture, but what are they doing here? What is the Lotus House community doing here?
Serving?
They're plotting what?
Seeds.
Yeah. Matter of fact, what they're doing is they're developing a community garden in a vacant lot right next to some of the crack houses. That's what they're doing. And what this tells me about biblical justice is a couple of things. Number one, biblical justice is hard work. It is not easy. One of the things that Wade and I have talked about a lot, is one of the goals of this degree is to get you to understand that biblical justice isn't this sensationalized going out and breaking into brothels and just rescuing children, although that happens. But that's not normally what your day-to-day life is going to be when you're serving biblical justice. Biblical justice looks a lot like this. And it may not, and I'm not saying building gardens, although that may be part of it too. But I'm saying biblical justice is hard work. And number two, biblical justice takes community. It's going to be a lot easier to do this entire lot if you have several people working than just one. And when you go into certain areas, the soil will not be ripe for a harvest, and you will need more than just yourself to do it. Matter of fact, that's one of the words of biblical at the very beginning, should almost in some sense be synonymous with community. And I know that, you know, I get always pushed back by even people on this campus of, "Well, you know, God saved the individual too." Yeah, I saved the individual so we can usher him into a community. I get it. I get it that there is a personal level to this, which is amazing, and I'm very thankful for it. But it's not in lieu of a community. And frankly, we can't do much without each other. This also reminds me that this is biblical justice is about breaking barriers. This is a group of white people in a predominantly black community. As a matter of fact, and I don't know if Alden's up there. I don't think that could be Alden. Him and his wife just adopted 3 kids from the local area that are African American. They're black skinned, and the community is looking at this house saying, matter of fact, one of them just finally looked at him and was like, "What are you guys, Mormons?" Like they didn't know what was going on. It's like, "No, but we do love Jesus." You know, and it's just breaking barriers, economic barriers, racial barriers. Whatever barriers you find that do not bring restoration to the hearts of the people, biblical justice will go after. This also reminds me, and again, this is the word I've used multiple times now, biblical justice is about transformation. That's just what it does. It transforms. It brings life where there is death. I had several definitions that I wrote down, biblical justice, and all of them, I actually think it's dangerous to reduce biblical justice down to just one word's definition. But one of them that I wrote was, biblical justice is allowing old creation to experience new creation in the present. That's biblical justice. And it points towards what we're headed to in the future. But biblical justice is engaging old creation, allowing them to taste new creation in the present, knowing what we're moving towards in the future. Biblical justice, and this is probably the best definition I can come up with, and it's not because it's the churchy one, it's because it's the right one. Biblical justice is imitating Christ. Now notice what I said there. Imitating Jesus. And we'll talk about why that's a little bit Well, we'll get to that in a bit. Biblical justice imitating Christ and all that that entails. And what I mean by that is justice and success, and we've already alluded to this, cannot be measured by the world, but it must be measured by the cross. And that changes the definition of justice completely. Absolutely completely. Because frankly, a lot of times what justice looks like is not the scales being balanced. It's just not. What it looks like is the scale not being balanced for you so that someone else can have theirs be a little more balanced. That's imitating Christ. Biblical justice is us enacting the story of God. See, the scriptures don't just narrate, they dictate. They're not just good stories, they are actually the ethical demands of who we are to be. As a matter of fact, Samuel Wells in his book Improvisation says, the performance of scripture is the life of the church. We perform the scriptures, and that's biblical justice. We perform them. We act them out. The story is not just something we read, it's something we become. So, now I'm going to ask a different question. For the next 8 minutes, we'll probably stay with this one, and then we'll pick this up on Tuesday. Why biblical justice? Not what, but why. Why biblical justice? And here's my first answer. Well, no, here is the answer. Because God desires it. It's actually pretty simple. Why biblical justice? Because God desires it. And we can see that in a couple different ways. First of all, He commands it. And second of all, He punishes those that ignore it. Which tells me what He kind of wants and desires and wills. He commands it. We're going to look at a lot of scriptures here just to prove that this is something that is true. And actually, you're going to notice they're all in the Old Testament. God commands it. Exodus chapter 22, verses 25 through 27, and then we'll get to 23. And let me just kind of give you the context here. We've just had the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20, where God reveals Himself to the people through what He commands, what He desires. And now in Exodus 22 and 23, and we'll even have Leviticus thrown in here, it's kind of an extrapolation, an explanation of the Ten Commandments through smaller commandments. These are the outworkings, the natural outworkings of the Ten Commandments. And so Exodus 22 begins by saying that God commands, and here's the first category, economic protection. God commands economic protection. And that's what you find here in Exodus 22. If you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, well, do not treat it like a business deal with charge and charge no interest. If you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it by sunset because that cloak is the only covering your neighbor even has. What else can they sleep in? I mean, when they cry out to me, listen to this. I will hear you, or I will hear, for I am compassionate. Now notice what He's doing. He's giving a command, and what's He attaching it to in the last phrase? His very identity. The next passage. This is judicial protection. Exodus 23. Do not deny justice to your poor or people in their lawsuits. Judicially, He's going to protect them. You have nothing to do with a false charge, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. No, isn't that interesting? You don't put an innocent man to death, because I'm telling you right now, I will not acquit the guilty. Who's guilty in that one? Not the person that dies, the one that put them to death. See what He's saying? He's protecting them judiciously. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the innocent. Do not oppress a foreigner. Notice His heart here, by the way. You yourselves know how it feels to be foreigners, don't you? Because you were foreigners in Egypt. So He says, I'm not even just talking about the people that's in your own little clan. I'm even talking about those that are outside of your clan. Why? You know what it's like to be foreigners in Egypt. What's He tapping into in that last phrase? Identity. The identity. Their story. Remember your story? Remember where you came from? Remember Egypt? Remember what happened there? Remember how they treated you? Now, if you treat people like that, I'm going to treat you the way I treated the Egyptians. Sound good? See what He's saying? God commands biblical justice. Keep going. Provision protection. I know that's not a really good category, but that's what we're going to call it for now. Provision. Day-to-day provision is what we find in Leviticus 19. when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. No, leave them for the poor and the foreigner. I am the Lord your God. He attaches it to what? His identity. Also, provision protection in the year of Jubilee. For 6 years you are to sow your fields and harvest the crops. But during the seventh year, let the land lie unplowed and unused. Interesting how God even is protecting the land there. Give it a year off. Let it rest. Then he says, then the poor among your people may get fed from it, and the wild animals may eat what is left. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. In the year of Jubilee, you let the land rest, and you allow the food that comes out of there naturally to provide for the poor and for even the wild animals. Interesting. A summary of this... Was I one ahead? Oh, man, I'm sorry. I was reading the one that... Okay, sorry. This, though, is a kind of a summary of these provision protections, Deuteronomy 15. If anyone is poor among your fellow Israelites in any of the towns of the land the Lord your God has given you, you do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward them. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend them whatever they need. Be careful not to harbor this wicked thought. Man, you know, the seventh year is coming for canceling the debts, so I probably shouldn't lend it to anybody. Because, I mean, it's coming close, and if I lend it to them, then the debt's going to be canceled, and then I'm out money. He says, don't let that wicked thought come to your mind, so that you do not show ill will toward the needy among your fellow Israelites and give them nothing. They may then appeal to the Lord, and this is what he says, they may appeal to the Lord against you, and you will be found guilty of sin. Give generously to them, and do so without a grudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. It doesn't mean, the word blessed doesn't mean you'll get more money. Okay, just, it doesn't. It means, something a lot greater than that. There will always be poor people in the land. Heard that verse before? Heard that verse? Who says that? Who says it? Jesus. Good job. But notice what follows it. Because we'll talk about later how people will use that verse as a reason why we shouldn't worry about the poor. There's always going to be poor people among you. But God says, since there's always poor people among you, therefore I command you to be open-handed toward your fellow Israelites and who are poor and needy in your land. He says, there's always an opportunity for you to reflect me. Always an opportunity. So if you're going, I don't know who to give. No. There's always poor people among you. Don't act like there isn't. That may even be a little bit of a frightening thing if you look at your churches and you can't say that your church actually does have that. That may be a problem too. Are there poor people among you when you sit in your church? And if there isn't, why? Why not? Where are they? God thinks that they should be a part of His people, which is where if we're acting with biblical justice, that's exactly where they would want to be. But maybe they don't want to be there because we're not acting biblically just. Then God talks about work protection, not just provision protection, but work protection. And it's closely related. Weekly, God says in Exodus 23:12, 6 days do your work, but on the seventh day do not work, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and so that the slave born in your household and the foreigner living among you may be refreshed. The Sabbath is a gift to protect and to bring justice. And also the year of Jubilee. Deuteronomy 15 says, if any of your people, Hebrew men or women, sell themselves to you and serve you 6 years, in the seventh year you must let them go free. And when you release them, do not send them away empty-handed. Now listen to this. You supply them liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your wine press. You give to them as the Lord God has blessed you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. Notice what he's tapping into. And the Lord your God redeemed you. And that is why I give you this command today. He says, if you are worshiping me, you should be acting like me. And what did I do for you? I mean, this shouldn't be rocket science. I mean, Jesus says this quite a few times when we get to the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, even the golden rule on some level is this, except for it's not just due to others as you'd have them do to you. It's due to others what Christ did for you. There's a little bit of a nuance there. And that's the very heartbeat of biblical justice, but we're not there yet. Right now, we're just looking at the question, why biblical justice, and we're answering it in the sense that God commanded it. So let's move to a couple more commands just so that you get the picture. This is Deuteronomy 10, after Moses has spent 40 days and 40 nights on the mountain with God, and he comes down after the golden calf debacle, which was a little bit before that. But Moses then receives this powerful command and then description of God. It says, "And now Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you? What does He command? He asks you to fear the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to Him, to love Him, to serve the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I'm giving you today for your own good." What does He ask? For you to actually listen to Him and to serve Him and obey Him. Well, what is He asking me to obey? Just go four verses later to verse 17. This is what He says. "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords. The great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality." We heard that at some point. "And accepts no bribes." Notice how it begins though. "This is who I am. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow." And then you almost hear in the background, "Do you?" "And He loves the foreigner residing among you." Do you? I will say right now, man, do I want to say that? Yeah. The immigration problem in our country for Christians should be an awesome opportunity for the gospel to spread. And if you read God's heart at all, it might change the way in which you're treating those people. Foreigners comes up inside of the Old Testament all the time. And matter of fact, in the New Testament, we're the ones called foreigners. We are strangers in this land, not them. Anyway, "Foreigners resided among you, giving them food and clothing, and you are to love those who are foreigners. For you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt." This is our story. Or it should be. And my goodness, Micah 6:8 summarizes this all so wonderfully. "He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." I agree with Randy Garris's interpretation of this verse. He says that in order to understand how to walk humbly with your God, you have to do the first two. The first two lead to the third. It's not three things he's listing. It's first two causally related to the third. You want to know how to walk humbly with the Lord your God? Act justly and love mercy. And then you'll naturally find yourself walking next to the one that is just and merciful. We will then... we'll progress on more of that on Tuesday. But until then, love you guys. See you then. Have a good weekend.